From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Republican National Convention is just days away. We'll be broadcasting from Cleveland next week. Can't wait. But some top Republicans, for instance, any of the past Bush presidents and the once and future President Jeb Bush, are going to skip it.
And many politicians are skipping it in protest of Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee. Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee will be at the convention. She will be speaking there. And she joins us via Skype from Washington. Congresswoman, welcome. And what do you say to some of your fellow Republicans, including former nominees Mitt Romney and John McCain, who are not going to Cleveland?
Well, I have to tell you, I think that you have to remember that when we focus on personalities, we lose. When we focus on principles and people, we win. And that is what these individuals should do. Basically, I look at them and say, get over yourself. Shake it off. They need to realize that this is about getting the country back on the track. 85% of all Americans think the country is on the wrong track, and it is imperative that we communicate to them why Republican principles are the best way for getting back on track.
And to that end, what would you say to Donald Trump, your presumptive nominee, about how to do that, how to unify the party and bring some of these people who are a little unsure about him into the fold?
Listen more, talk less, support the party platform.
Talk less. That's going to be tough for a presidential nominee, isn't it?
Oh, I tell you what. Sometimes when you listen more and talk a little less, and then it always pays off.
So when we spoke to you in Tennessee right before the primary in Tennessee, you said that as a mom and a grandma, that some of the things that Trump had said made you a little uncomfortable listening to them. Do you think that he's moderated his tone enough to your satisfaction?
I think he has moderated his tone. I think he is listening more and he is responding more. You know, just as we talked in Tennessee, there are three issues that are out there. You have national security, jobs and economic security, and retirement security. And with women, security issue is number one. And I can certainly understand that. First and foremost is they want to make certain that their communities are secure, that our borders are secure, that they aren't having to worry about the threat of ISIS. It's the number one issue with women. Women are going to be the determining factor in this election season.
So to that end, what do you think about the people that have been talked about as a potential Trump VP nominee, Newt Gingrich, Mike Pence, and Chris Christie?
I think that what people are looking for in a ticket is leadership. And gender is not a qualifier for leadership. They're good people. They're good people.
Do you have a favorite of them?
I don't. I think Mr. Trump is going to choose someone that he feels like best balances him and the ticket and make certain that we win in November.
If it's you, would you accept?
Of course I would accept.
I want to ask you about one more thing. It's a letter that you circulated to some members of Congress this week calling the Clinton Foundation a lawless pay-to-play enterprise. Now, some people will hear that, and after years of investigations into Benghazi and the emails, we'll say this is just politics. This is political. How do you respond to those people?
We've been looking at this issue of the Clinton Foundation for quite a period of time, going back to May 2015, when a group of us, 58 of us, wrote the IRS and asked if this was a sham charity. They never even responded. We also have since found out that the Clintons have never filed a 9/11 that allows them to do work outside of the United States for this foundation. And the Clinton Foundation was formed initially, their IRS papers from December 23rd of 97 show that they were filed to construct a library, maintain a historical site with records, and engage in study and research. There is nothing that says something about foreign outreach. So we are seeking answers.
But do you think it's appropriate to be seeking answers to this extent for so many years about every detail of the Clintons' lives when we didn't spend this much time on an investigation into the Iraq War in this country?
Of course, it's appropriate to ask for this investigation. The Iraq War, I'm not sure what your analogy is there. The Iraq War has been investigated time and time again. What we do know with the Clintons is that there are some concerns around the Clinton Foundation. And before the election, it is appropriate that these be addressed. The way grants were given to some of those that were friendly to the Clinton Foundation, the way they accepted foreign contributions that were made to the Clinton Foundation, the way Mrs. Clinton participated in relationships with some of those foreign entities. So, yes, it is appropriate that those be answered. Listen, let me tell you something. People are tired of cronyism. They are tired of elitism. They are tired of there being one set of rules for those that are the elitist and another set of rules for everybody else.
That's Marsha Blackburn, Congresswoman from Tennessee, Republican, who will be speaking at the convention in Cleveland next week. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, yesterday, in his remarks at the memorial service for five police officers in Dallas, President Obama talked about our failed education system and how police officers are being asked to be social workers, parents, you could add truant officers. Last summer, Miami-Dade Public Schools announced a plan to keep kids who got in trouble in school instead of sending them out on the streets where they'd be the business of the police or just drop out altogether if they got suspended. The school system came up with something called success centers, but as Rowan Moore Garrity of Here and Now contributor WLRN reports, there's still a long way to go before success centers live up to their name.
Visit a success center with a representative from the school district and the scene as much as it's supposed to be.
Turn to the 24 questions, remember?
At a success center in Miami, an instructor reviews character building worksheets with a group of 10 students.
Okay, that's the one that you have to kind of search yourself. Think about where you are in your life.
In a side office, a counselor has a one-on-one session with the middle schooler. But talk with staff and students who spend time there, and a different picture emerges. One problem is schoolwork. School officials say it's the responsibility of the students' schools to make sure they get their work.
What happens is we can contact the school.
Marcia Misick is a counselor at one of the district's 10 success centers.
But if the school doesn't send it, then we don't have anything for the students. So we give them the handouts that we have here. The negative part about it is they're not getting graded for what we do. So if you're here for 10 days and your school didn't send you anything, you're 10 days without grades.
At her center, Misick says that's the case most of the time. Staff members at other centers say they had better luck, but cite delays and miscommunication. Some said schoolwork only comes when parents arrange to get it themselves. 12th grader Madeline Moran got a 10-day suspension after an argument with another student and a teacher. When she showed up at the Success Center on day one, it wasn't just that her schoolwork wasn't there.
You're basically treated like a baby, and it shouldn't have to be like that.
Madeline says she had to do the same worksheets as 11 and 12-year-olds there with her and get in a straight line to walk to lunch. Add the fact that it was hard for her to get a ride.
For the 9 days remaining, I just stayed home.
Exactly the outcome success centers aim to prevent. Students elsewhere reported copying rules over and over again and filling pages with the word responsibility. Staff and students say some centers offered no access to one-on-one counseling. But Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho says the initiative is an urgent fix to help end the school-to-prison pipeline.
The reality here is 100% of the kids used to be put out of school, out of class, out of school, no accountability, no questions asked. When they returned, nothing. We needed to end a terrible policy that hurt kids.
Research has shown that suspensions increase the risk of dropping out and of getting arrested. Black students get suspended in disproportionate numbers. Community pressure around those very issues is part of what drove the superintendent to create success centers. But some educators say the superintendent moved too quickly.
We understand the reason behind not suspending the kids.
Wendell Nibbs has spent the last 15 years teaching at a school with one of Miami's highest suspension rates.
You can address the issue before you get to that level. We can't wait for the kid to get to the trauma unit. We can triage them before they get there.
Electives, like his PE classes, sometimes have upwards of 50 students. Nib says changing the culture around school discipline means doing more to support teachers on the front lines.
We have to have the proper infrastructure and how this is going to work, and everyone's going to buy in.
So far, there hasn't been district-wide training for teachers who write kids up for suspensions in the first place. But Superintendent Carvalho defends bringing in success centers quickly. He says the district will spend time this summer to improve the program.
We may not have everything figured out, but no matter what we do, by simply doing this, it is far better than what historically has happened across the country.
On paper, success centers brought the number of out-of-school suspensions to zero overnight. But at the end of the school year, what district officials don't know yet is how many of the students who were sent to success centers actually showed up. For Here and Now, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity in Miami.
And if you see a crab in the waters off the East Coast, it could be a green crab, an invasive predator that's destroying clam and scallop populations from South Carolina up to Maine. They were inadvertently introduced along the Atlantic coast 2 centuries ago, and now some chefs are looking to get rid of them by putting them on your dinner plate. Emily Corwin from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
I'm probably going to upset some of my fisherman friends.
Brendan Vesey is the chef at The Joinery, an upscale restaurant in Newmarket, New Hampshire.
Because I think tuna is delicious, and I understand why we catch it. But I currently don't serve it.
Why? He says eating that one big predator at the top of the food chain throws off the whole ecosystem. Instead of seared tuna steaks, his menu reads,
invasive green crab bisque with seared fish, fresh peas, and house-made bacon.
That's right, invasive green crab bisque for $10. That creepy sound is 20 pounds of green crabs clawing and crawling in a plastic bucket. Fisherman Everett Leach is dropping them off here at the restaurant. As he plucks one off the floor, another crawls right out of the bucket.
Keep an eye on them. They're runners.
Green crabs are native to Europe, but they arrived in New England 200 years ago, most likely in the hulls and ballasts of ships. They eat a lot of the moneymakers fishermen need to survive. Clams, oysters, mussels, soft-shell crabs, scallops. The Maine Clammers Association describes green crabs on their website as a cancer, literally eating away at Maine's marine resources. That's a quote.
Quantity is not a problem. There's millions of them.
VC pays $2 a pound for these guys, a third what he'd pay for steamer clams, a ninth what he'd pay for scallops.
All right, guys, it's your time.
Immediately, he starts throwing the crabs into 2 big stock pots.
I'm going to put them in a hot pot with some oil in the bottom and toast the shells up, and then I'll add liquid to make stock.
For now, stock is about the only thing you can make with green crabs. VC says you could spend hours shelling 20 pounds of them and only end up with a half pound of meat.
They're really small, and they're really, really hard. The shells rock hard.
So VC grinds them up and strains the shells and crab meat. The stock is green and pungent and tastes sweet and rich. VC hopes someday he can do something more with these little critters than just soup. Take blue crabs. Famous in Maryland, fishermen have figured out how to catch them just before they shed their shells, then harvest them while they're naked. That's why soft-shell crab is so popular. You get lots of meat with very little work.
If we had those, we could probably get rid of green crabs in a year, because everybody wants to eat that.
It's been 200 years since the New England shoreline was free of the invasive predator green crab. Without them, think of all the oysters and scallops there'd be to go around. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Corwin.
And now for a different kind of invasion, Hostel Living, the do-it-yourself travel show. Ray Williams took his savings, threw together a crew of friends who worked at a restaurant called Haru Sushi, and now they show up everywhere. Iceland, Panama, Vietnam, they're looking for adventure. And in one show in Colombia, they're looking for drug lord Pablo Escobar's brother. The entire Vietnam show is devoted to a search for foodie god Anthony Bourdain. That episode is called Hostel Living Vietnam, the Bourdain Experiment. Cameraman Mark Kelly shot this video of Ray Williams on the hunt for Bourdain.
Anthony Bourdain ate here, and we're hoping that whoever works here is going to offer up some clues as to his whereabouts and hopefully take us one step closer to finding Anthony Bourdain.
Very puzzled Vietnamese there. Hostel Living Vietnam, the Bourdain Experiment, won Best Experimental Film at the Manhattan Film Festival. And Ray Williams joins us in the studio. Hi, Ray.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm fine. And sitting next to you, Mark Kelly. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Interesting to see, after having watched that segment, you're still here.
I know.
Because the conceit, Mark, is that you're kind of being dragged along on this, oh, my God, really good friend. Is that real?
Tell the truth.
It's partly real, yeah. So this process has always been very difficult for me, and I kind of just let that out.
That is the despair of camera and sound people everywhere. Where is that person dragging me? You know, there's a little bit of that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that person will be you, Ray Williams.
Yes.
Where did this come from?
Hostile Living came to me purely just from a love of travel. And that somehow turned into this really ill-thought-out concept of a show called Hostile Living, which is a testament to the fact that when you're traveling on a budget, things aren't easy, they're not comfortable, and they're sometimes, you know, very hostile.
Yeah, and it's a play on words, too, because you often have to stay in hostels.
Exactly,
yeah.
Because there is no budget.
Now, did you train as a filmmaker?
No, I
sort of knew that.
Yes.
I just kind of asked.
Yes, it's one of those rhetorical questions.
Right.
I actually had zero knowledge of this coming into it. I had no idea what a DOP was or a producer.
Director of photography,
exactly.
Right.
So I went into it blind.
Well, and that circles us back to Mark Kelly, who is the camera sound man, working with someone who really has kind of no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, that was another big thing that made it hard to, I was always questioning myself, like, who am I following around? You know, like it.
And, you know, Ray, I asked Mark, is that a put on? And I want to ask you, I mean, sometimes you are, well, let's take the Vietnam episode. Sometimes you are painfully obtuse. I mean, you're standing in the middle of the most beautiful part of Vietnam, these fabulous characters circling around you. I'm watching you look at a picture of Anthony Bourdain that you have in your hand because that's who you want to find. And I'm thinking, look up, you know,
yeah.
At the people around you.
Well, it's funny because you asked him if, you know, these like opposite sort of personalities, if that was true. And he said yes, because that's a natural sort of dynamic of ours. But there is that person in me, too. It's just exaggerated.
It is. And at the end of the Vietnam piece, in effect, I'm paraphrasing
sure.
you say, I'm kind of realizing, what was I doing looking for him? The beauty of Vietnam was right there.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, why Anthony Bourdain?
Anthony Bourdain has always been a huge inspiration to us.
Because he does this travel, for people who don't know. He does this amazing show where he travels the world and he eats.
Yes, he eats. He wins Emmys, too. And, you know, to a lesser degree, here we are, this DIY travel show, funding it by bartending and landscaping. And we wanted to find a way to get our names out there.
Well, the contrast is pretty amazing. And because Mark, in particular, what we also see that we don't see with Anthony Bourdain, we see you. I mean, we see you questioning, you know, late at night you turn the camera on yourself. What were some of the questions that you ask yourself?
What am I doing? What am I doing with myself? What am I doing here?
But on the other hand, I'll start with you, Mark. You're in Vietnam. You know, I mean,
amazing.
Isn't it thrilling to be able to go through with your own kind of...
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that, I guess, you know, that always was on the back of my mind, is that I'm in this amazing place and I'm basically looking through a camera lens. I'm not seeing it with my own eyes. I'm too focused on the goal.
And Ray, you learn what people learn who travel and say, I'm with a television show. I mean, you ended up going to this wild party that you thought was a wedding.
Mm-hmm. We were told it was a wedding.
You're drinking with these. I don't think you know you speak the language at all, but you're. What'd you discover?
We come to find out that it wasn't a wedding, it was actually a funeral.
It gives new meaning to The Ugly American, which didn't you at some point you were going to read the Graham Greene because you felt, you know, you're trying to do. Well, tell me what you're trying to do. It sounds like you're trying to be the travel writer and documentarian that you've come to respect.
Yes. And Hostile Living is unique in the sense that it really does toe the line of mock and doc. And this is where that sort of exaggeration comes from, because that's a bullet I'm sort of willing to take as, you know, that over-the-top character who's completely oblivious and, you know, doesn't think what he's doing is absolutely nuts.
It's one thing to look for Anthony Bourdain. It's another thing to look for Pablo Escobar's brother at nighttime with lights being shown on you and, you know, your hands behind. I mean, this seemed more serious.
And it was.
Yeah.
That was one of those situations where being a show with no budget and the host being the producer allows you the flexibility of doing whatever sort of situation comes your way. Mm. We allowed ourselves to sort of let common sense fly out the window for mm-hmm. the sake of getting something. And actually, that's not mock. That's
yeah, that was serious.
That was real, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you want? I mean, if one of the travel channels or, you know, planet channels came to you and said, we'll give you a weekly half-hour slot and a budget, is that what you want? Or does that maybe jeopardize this notion? Because then with that comes tons of suits from the, you know, telling you how to do it.
I guess we've never known, really. I mean, it's been like the core of this thing that we do, it is a story about a group of guys trying to make it in TV and film. So, I mean, us trying to get to that point of being professionals, that's part of the story.
I've always sort of looked at it as more of a web thing, you know, which would allow us to keep a degree of creative control. But there are ways to do it through network TV that would allow us to sort of keep the same dynamic.
In other words, I'll take it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, fingers crossed for you. That's Ray Williams. We've also been speaking with Mark Kelly. They are Hostel Living. We'll link you up with their work and their Kickstarter campaign at hereandnow.org. Ray, Mark, thanks and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And it has been a week of economic records. Yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a record high. The S&P 500 did also for a second day in a row. The NASDAQ also reached positive territory for the first time all year. At the same time, today we got news that Venezuela's oil production fell to a 13-year low because of low oil prices, and the country is preparing for a worsening of its already terrible economic crisis. Maggie Lake is host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She's with us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the markets here in the U.S. What's going on here? What are some of the factors behind these record highs?
You know, I think it's really global. And what I hear over and over again from experts I talk to is that the U.S. economy looks like the best house in a bad neighborhood. But I guess we'll take that. You know, our economy's growing, not very quickly, but it's growing. We are adding jobs. Our banks are solid. Does that mean things are good for everyone? Absolutely not. Does it mean profits are going up for all companies? Absolutely not. But some of these solid companies are in good shape fiscally. They're paying dividends. And in a world where bonds pay nothing in your retirement, and in some countries they're actually having a negative yield, U.S. stock market looks like a pretty attractive place to invest. So you're seeing these global money flows pushing into our market and pushing stocks to record highs.
And I think back to a few of the key moments economically over the last few weeks. Last week, we got a very good jobs report from the Labor mm-hmm. Department for the last month. But then,
right.
you know, not too long ago, everybody was worried that Brexit, the vote for Britain to leave the EU, was going to send at least the UK and maybe more countries into recession. So is this a trend, or is this kind of just going to be a roller coaster up and down for a while longer?
Yeah, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to stay this way, this whipping around. I mean, all of those underlying worries haven't changed, except that we are seeing this money try to find a home. I mean, right now, CNN Money's Fear and Greed Index is flashing extreme greed. But whenever you see extremes, you're vulnerable, right? We've got China to worry about. We still have Brexit. We don't know how that's going to play out. These low oil prices you mentioned in the intro, they can be destabilizing for some countries. So you've got those global worries. And, you know, Jeremy, it's interesting. You also have a situation where a lot of hedge funds got it wrong in the beginning of the year and throughout. They're underperforming. And when that's the case, they tend to have more of a trigger finger. They don't want to be on the losing side if the markets are moving, or some of them are facing redemption, so they've got to liquidate their winners. So that can also add to that volatility we're seeing.
And we talked about a place where things are not good at all, Venezuela. They're already facing food shortages, skyrocketing inflation, power outages there. And now word that oil production has dramatically fallen because of these low prices. What's going on that's obviously not the only big oil producer in the world. So I imagine others are looking at this and saying this could be really bad for us.
But they're in a particular situation where they've been facing years of underinvestment under the Maduro government, and before that, Chavez. They've been cut off from the global financial system, and so that's really making the situation even more severe. I've got to tell you, my colleague Paula Newton is on the ground there. We did it in my show today. It is hard to watch what's happening there. This is a country that is coming apart at the seams. People don't have food. They don't have medicine, basic sanitation. People are being held hostage for ransom. I mean, this is really getting dire. The army's been called in to try to distribute the food, but it appears that is just not enough. And the Maduro government and opposition party are deadlocked. So this is a country that is the social fabric's breaking down. So we're watching it very carefully. It is becoming a humanitarian crisis.
And crude oil falling another 4.5% today.
With no reprieve in sight. That's right.
Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Britain has a new prime minister. It is Theresa May, Britain's former Home Secretary. She met with Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace this afternoon and then returned to the prime minister's residence, number 10 Downing Street, where she spoke for the first time as leader of the new British government.
Following the referendum, we face a time of great national change. And I know, because we're Great Britain, that we will rise to the challenge.
May succeeds David Cameron, who resigned after voters rejected his bid to keep the UK in the European Union. She also supported the Remain campaign, but she has said she will follow the will of the voters. Earlier today, before he left office, Cameron made a final appearance before the House of Commons for Prime Minister's questions.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister.
Each Wednesday, British prime ministers stand in what's called the dispatch box and answer questions from the opposition.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. Other than one meeting this afternoon with Her Majesty the Queen, the diary for the rest of my day is remarkably light.
It's often a raucous give and take on the major issues of the day.
If I can go to my pet subject, Brexit really threatens. Thank you.
Do in this house, we do need to make sure that we do need to make sure that as we leave the European Union, we work out how to keep the benefits of the common travel area. Hard work is being
done. But overall, today the tone reflected a farewell.
The last thing I'd say is that you can achieve a lot of things in politics. You can get a lot of things done, and that, in the end, the public service, the national interest, that is what it's all about. Nothing is really impossible if you put your mind to it. After all, as I once said, I was the future once.
David Cameron there poking fun at himself, recalling a barb he aimed at Prime Minister Tony Blair more than a decade ago when he said to Blair, "You were the future once." Well, in Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who took office in November, has been a very different leader than his predecessor, Conservative Stephen Harper. Trudeau ran as a Liberal reformer, and he has certainly lived up to that title. Ashifa Kassam is Canada correspondent for The Guardian. She joins us on Skype from Toronto. And Ashifa, I want to start with the issue of gay rights, because Justin Trudeau recently marched in Toronto's Gay Pride Parade. He was the first prime minister to do so, and he walked next to a Syrian refugee. He also announced that Canada is exploring gender-neutral ID cards. Tell us about his policy on LGBT issues.
Yeah, so that day when he kind of did all those things in one day was kind of a great example of how different he is from his predecessor. So as you mentioned, he was kind of the first one to march in this parade and to lead the parade. And as part of that as well, he announced that he was pushing forward. So a few months earlier, he had passed legislation to really kind of protect transgender people, so protect them from discrimination the same way that religious minorities or people of differing sexual orientations are protected right now in Canada. And so during the Pride Parade, he had announced that essentially he would push forward this legislation by adding or by contemplating whether Canada could look into gender-neutral IDs. And so those are IDs that would allow kind of a third gender specification more than just male and female.
And is this shift in policy from the previous administration a sign of Justin Trudeau's personal views, his politics, or is this a generational thing because he's a young guy?
I think it's actually a combination of all three. It's a good question. I think that what you're seeing is kind of his politics and the way that he thinks about things. But I also think that his campaign was hugely successful with younger people. Voter turnout among younger people was way high up in the last election. And a lot of those people voted for Trudeau. And part of that was these promises like protecting transgender rights, things like the legalization of marijuana, things that really his predecessors never contemplated because they were really considering looking at kind of the older baby boomers generation in terms of votes and not so much the younger ones. So I think what we're seeing is this push to kind of embody these views that are a lot more kind of associated with the younger generation.
Is there a lot of opposition, though, from the older generation or from people who don't share his politics? Are they being vocal in their opposition to what he's proposing?
There hasn't been, but that might be mostly because of the way that the campaign came down and the way that the election came down. Trudeau, kind of until the last few weeks of the campaign, nobody really expected him to do as well as he did. Everybody knew that Canadians were looking for change. Kind of from the get-go, the polls were showing that the Conservative government, who had been in power for about 9 years, that people didn't want to re-elect them, that they were looking for something new. And until the last minute, kind of Trudeau pulled ahead in a majority, and it was kind of a signal to the Conservatives to kind of turn around and start doing things differently. So earlier this year at their party convention, for example, they kind of agreed that they would no longer contest the idea of gay marriage, which in Canada has been about, I think it's just over 10 years now that it's been legal. So things like that. So we've actually seen, and in that pride parade that Trudeau was at, there was actually political representatives from pretty much every party in Canada also marching behind them. So you're really starting to see kind of an embrace of these issues kind of across the Canadian political spectrum.
And what about his views on immigration? He defended Canada's Syrian refugee settlement program. He welcomed Syrian refugees at the airport. But where does he stand on the issue of immigration?
Yeah, he's been, I guess Syrian refugees has kind of been his big, it's been his banner campaign promise, and that was something kind of from the get-go in the campaign, he really differentiated himself from the other candidates, promising to bring in 25,000 Syrian refugees as soon as possible, as opposed to the Conservatives, for example, who were promising, I think, 10,000 refugees over 4 years. The numbers show that the support for bringing in Syrian refugees remains quite high, even now it's been 6 months or so, and we've had about 28,000, more than 28,000 people arrive so far.
What are the other issues that you look at where he really has taken a big turn to the left?
It's kind of these very soft issues that he's been really good at pushing forward. So things like feminism, kind of it's been all over international media that Justin Trudeau has been very open about speaking about the fact that he's a feminist. Him and his wife have put forward a relationship that they call a shoulder-to-shoulder relationship, and he's very open about fighting for women's rights. And I think that is a really interesting departure from kind of also the previous government who was had during kind of rounds of budget cuts. He had taken aim at programs defending women's rights. But it's also a different face for a world leader, right? You very rarely hear world leaders kind of going on about feminism. Another way that he did that was when he appointed his cabinet, he appointed 50% women. Hmm. And it's a very diverse cabinet that looks a lot closer to Canada than most cabinets do.
Any other issues?
So the legalization of marijuana is a big one, and it's very different. It's pushing forward something that had been kind of kicking around for a long time, but we haven't necessarily coalesced around doing it as a country, and that is a huge, it will be a huge thing to wrangle, and so they're working on that as well.
And how much opposition does he face? I think back to when President Obama came into office and he took on this issue of universal health care and tried to push through that, and it was very, very difficult. There was a lot of opposition, not just in Washington, but around the country to what he was trying to do. Does Trudeau face that kind of opposition?
He's in a glorious place right now because there's really not an official leader of either the official opposition or the NDP. So the official opposition, their leader was the former prime minister. He stepped down after the election and they've got an interim leader right now. And same with the NDP. Earlier this year, they voted to get rid of their leader as well. I think he's still on, but essentially they're going to replace him as well. And so because he's essentially facing off against two parties that are, you know, for the most part, leaderless, that don't really know which direction they want to go. They just know that they need to change. And so that really has weakened the opposition that he's facing in the country.
And that comparison to President Obama in this country, how similar are they?
Truthfully, I mean, Obama is just, he's such a great orator. He's such a great speech maker. And so it was funny to see the contrast of the two of them at the recent Three Amigos summit. Obama comes across at this point as kind of a a politician who's been around, who knows how to speak to people, who knows how to do these issues, whereas Trudeau is still finding his feet at times. I mean, you saw a little bit of that. There was this social media scandal, we can call it, because it was kind of very much blown up, where he had kind of strode across the floor of Parliament, and in the process of grabbing someone, he had accidentally elbowed another politician.
Right.
And it kind of blew up over social media, and people were watching this video, and they were saying, you know, how could he do this? He lost his temper. And I guess it was a sign that this is a government that's still very new, that's still finding its feet.
That's Ashifa Kassam, who is Canada correspondent for The Guardian, talking to us about Justin Trudeau, the new prime minister in Canada, and somebody that many liberals in Canada and outside of Canada are looking to as a new leader of the left. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Okay, it's confession time. Do you shop at department stores? Go in, maybe buy a few things to try on at home. What the hey? The return policies have gotten really liberal. Maybe splurge on that gown for a wedding. It's way too expensive, but hey, you can bring it back. They'll just resell it, right? Well, the store may be fine, but if the salespeople work on commission, they will lose the money on that sale. Macy's, Bloomingdale's, and Saks all deduct commissions after returns up to 6 months after the sale. And according to the National Retail Federation, returns are up 53% in the last 5 years, and that's been tough on salespeople. Michelle Zarella was a personal stylist at one of those upscale stores. And Michelle, do I understand you left because sometimes you'd owe the store money?
Yeah, you know, I love what I did. I loved working with my clients and helping style them, but it just got really difficult. Some of the returns that I would get dinged with when they'd get back, oftentimes I'd start the week in negative sales. And also with the store traffic, there's just, you know, so many more options out there with other stores and the internet. It became difficult.
So explain how it works, because you do have a, I'm doing air quotes, salary from the store.
Correct. Yeah, you do have a base salary that you have to work against for your commissions.
So, for instance, you might make $10 or $15 an hour. Let's say you work 35 hours a week. So there's a rough base of $300-something dollars. And you make sales up to that. But if you start making sales over that, then you have sort of bonuses.
Exactly. So you really would set yourself a goal as a salesperson. I need to sell X amount this week to at least cover my base.
Right. And so conversely, if you don't make enough sales to cover that base, you don't even get the base. And if people start returning the things that you thought were adding up, you start, what, you're in the negative.
You're in the negative, yes, yeah, until you can build yourself back up and sort of basically climb yourself out of a hole.
Give me a sense of what you might sell and then what might come back.
I think I saw more of it when we had sort of our sales, you know, our big, you know, 70% off or 50% off sales. People, I think, saw, well, you know, I think I like this outfit. I'll buy a couple of them because I do have a wedding to come to. Typically, about a week or 2 weeks later, you'd see those items come back.
Yeah, maybe after the wedding. The New York Times took a look at this. There's a young woman at Macy's, and she gets a bottle of perfume that was bought weeks earlier, almost used up. And it's still going to count against her sales for that week. Another person in a luggage department at another store talks about knowing that when people, they come in, they announce they're going to go on a trip, they will be back in a week after that trip returning the luggage.
Yeah. You know, where I worked, it wasn't as liberal as that. It was a luxury retailer where we were pretty stringent on that. We had a very short window of like 30 days to return. But oftentimes it happens.
Well, let's talk about what might be going on here. The Times quotes researchers for Stella Service, that's a customer research firm, and they say it's because of online shopping, that people who have been buying online have been conditioned to, first of all, they can return it whenever they want, and they don't think of there being a salesperson.
I definitely think the internet is, and online sales is hugely impacting the industry. I think it is changing the dynamics of how people shop.
Macy's went to a 6-month return policy, then it eliminated any time limit. You still can't, you know, dock from a worker's pay after 6 months, I believe. But what's that like to have an expectation you're going to be making a certain amount and then the returns come in and you don't?
It's really a challenge. Personally, I used to get a lot of satisfaction. I felt like I served a great need for my any customer or client that I had. And then when something would return, you know, not only do you feel like, you know, I'm not making the money that I wanted to be making, you also feel a little bit of like a failure. Like, how did I fail that customer?
When, in fact, that customer bought five of the same things
sure.
to go try them on.
Yeah, you know, I think it's people just don't understand how that actually impacts a financial basis, the person who's actually in front of you selling this merchandise to you.
What's it called when you are realizing that you're not going to go above your base, but you're below? What's that called?
Arrears.
So do you, in effect, have to pay the store back?
It comes out of the next paycheck.
Why don't salespeople tell people this?
Yeah, that's a hard conversation to have with a customer.
Well, we just had it. Hopefully we'll get the word out. Now, you've left sales. Was it because of this?
I went into it because it's something, a field I really was passionate about. I love interacting with customers, and I love being in the fashion industry, but it was just difficult. I just, you know, at the end of the day, I just really wasn't able to make the money that I wanted to make. So, you know, it's such a shame. I mean, not only the money, but it's also the time. I mean, as someone who actually really loves doing this kind of work, you spend a lot of time, 2, 3, 4 hours, styling people head to toe. And then to have, you know, a week or two later, all that stuff come back, it's a challenge.
It's a double whammy.
Yeah.
Would it help if things were changed? Some consumer groups and unions want to amend the return policies. For instance, Bloomingdale's was pressured to reduce the return window from 180 to 150 days and then to 120. So you might not find out for 3 months that you're going to lose money from a sale.
Yeah. You know, I think it's going to have to change. I think the whole model of the way sales works, especially in brick and mortar stores, is going to have to definitely change. I don't know if there'll ever be a day, I mean, hopefully there will be, that salespeople won't get dinged for those returns. There's got to be a better way, I think.
Michelle Zarella, former retail salesperson, talking about the return policy and its repercussion on salespeople. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So are you a salesperson? Is this ringing true for you? Or a consumer? Will this change your personal return policy? I know I'm never returning anything again. Let us hear from you at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.